This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off this week. Today's Bradcast was originally recorded on November 12th, 2025.
It's past time for Congress to restore its role as a check and balance on this administration and fight for we, the American people. That's what the American people expect us to do. Fight for them. That is why I will sign the discharge petition right now to release the Epstein files.
That can't be good for Trump.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling there's something right.
No,
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right, here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. All right, joining me shortly, the great Richard R.J. Eskow of the Zero Hour. He's a longtime friend of this program, a columnist, broadcaster, former lead writer for Bernie Sanders back in his 2016 presidential campaign days. Who we have not spoken to Richard in years, I think it's been, Desiree.
Yeah, and I'm glad to have him back.
Me too. Hi, Desi Doyen. Glad to have you back as well. Richard recently wrote about the cost of now New York City Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani's affordability agenda for free buses, a rent freeze, universal child care, city-owned grocery store pilot program, describing at least three of those four things as surprisingly inexpensive, quipping that he, quote, wished all revolutions came this cheap. That in response to so many claiming that New York simply cannot afford these expensive, radical, socialist, nay, communist ideas. Well, now that Zohran has been elected in a landslide, Richard will join us to break down the real costs of Mamdani's proposed affordability agenda. But first, we noted yesterday that while those seven Democrats and one independent who caucuses with them in the U.S. Senate, who pulled the rug out from under the rest of the Democratic caucus previously, running a successful and united campaign to insist Republicans restore trillions of dollars in health care cuts before the end of the year, resulting in a standoff with Republicans that became the longest federal government shutdown in U.S. history. We noted yesterday that there was an upside to that cave by those Democrats to ending the shutdown with no guarantees whatsoever for any such restoration of health care funding. Reopening the government would at least require that Speaker Mike Johnson reopen the U.S. House, which he had shut down for an unprecedented nearly 2 months. He claimed it was because the federal government was shut down, which was always a ridiculous claim, when in fact the obvious reason for recessing the House for so long was to avoid swearing in Arizona's Adelita Grijalva, who won her special election to the U.S. House almost 2 months ago. Grijalva had vowed to be the final 218th needed signature on the discharge petition to call for a vote on the release of the Epstein files. So Speaker Johnson, in hopes of protecting Donald Trump, simply kept the House on recess to prevent her from being sworn in and from the House having to take the vote to release those files, in which Donald Trump himself, child sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein's best friend for many, many years, is said to be cited multiple times throughout. Well, before all of that could even happen on Wednesday, House Democrats on Wednesday morning released a few emails citing Donald Trump's very close relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. House Democrats released emails in which Epstein wrote that Donald Trump had, quote, spent hours at my house, unquote, with one of Mr. Epstein's victims, among other messages that suggested that the convicted sex offender believed that Trump knew more about his abuse than he has acknowledged. Trump has emphatically denied any involvement in or knowledge of Epstein's sex trafficking operation, though does anyone actually believe that anymore? He has said that he and Epstein, the disgraced financier who died by suicide in federal prison back in 2019, were once friendly but had a falling out. Democrats on the House Oversight Committee said that these emails raised new questions about the relationship between the two men. In one of the messages, Epstein flatly asserts that Trump, quote, knew about the girls, unquote, many of whom were later found by investigators to have been underage. In another, Epstein pondered how to address questions from the news media about their relationship as Trump was becoming a national political figure. Democrats on the House Oversight Committee said that the messages raised new questions about the relationship between Epstein and Trump. The emails were turned over to the committee in response to a set of subpoenas that Democrats effectively forced Republicans to issue for files related to Epstein. So far, the Justice Department has provided the oversight panel with little that was not already public. They said they wanted all the files, so they gave them a whole bunch of files that had already been released. Thus, the call by all Democrats in the House and four Republicans to, in fact, release the full Epstein files via the discharge petition that Mike Johnson has been preventing from receiving that 218th signature that would result on a vote on this matter for releasing all of the files currently being covered up at the DOJ, obviously at the order of Donald Trump, who claimed repeatedly during his campaign that he would, of course, release all of the Epstein files if he was elected. Turns out maybe he's a liar. Who knew? But it turns out he may also be a pedophile if what is in those files ever come to light. The three separate email exchanges released on Wednesday were all from after Epstein's 2008 plea deal in Florida on state charges of soliciting prostitution, in which federal prosecutors agreed not to pursue any further charges. They came years after Trump and Epstein had a reported falling out in the early 2000s. One of the emails was addressed to Epstein's longtime confidant, Ghislaine Maxwell, while two were with the author, Michael Wolff. In one email from April 2011, Epstein told Maxwell, who was later convicted on charges relating to facilitating his crimes, quote, I want you to realize that that dog that hasn't barked is Trump. He added that an unnamed victim, quote, spent hours at my house with him, noting the quote, he has never once been mentioned, presumably a reference to the public reporting to date at the time on Epstein and the others involved in whatever was going on at his properties. Quote, I've been thinking about that, Maxwell wrote back. Again, that was in 2011. It was long before Trump's first 2015 campaign for president, so dismissing those remarks from Epstein that, you know, Trump had spent hours with one of the victims at his house as some sort of a political smear to try and hurt Trump politically. Well, that just makes no sense whatsoever because this was 2011. And then in an email from January 2019 that, of course, after Trump had been in office for 2 years, Epstein wrote to the author Michael Wolff about Trump, quote, of course he knew about the girls. The emails were provided to the Oversight Committee along with a large tranche of documents from Epstein's estate, according to the New York Times. So apparently these would be separate from the allegedly hundreds of thousands of pages of investigative files, purportedly including photographs and videos, whose release is currently being held up by Trump's Attorney General, Pam Bondi. in hopes, obviously, of distracting from the emails released by the Democrats on the committee early on Wednesday. The Republican chair of the committee, just a few hours later, subsequently released some 23,000 documents provided by Epstein's estate to the Oversight Committee.
Oh, so Republicans had these emails the whole time that they could have released.
Apparently so. And much more. Apparently some 23,000 documents that they've suddenly decided to dump. That after claiming that, quote, Democrats continue to carelessly cherry pick documents to generate clickbait that is not grounded in the facts. That according to a committee spokesperson charging that Democrats are once again intentionally withholding records that name Democrat officials. Well, okay. I don't know whether that is true or not. If so, I'm glad that the Republicans released those, 20,000, 23,000 pages of documents, none of which change the actual evidence that is presented in those emails released on Wednesday morning from Epstein charging that Donald Trump, quote, knew about the girls, and that Epstein said way back in 2011 that Trump, quote, spent hours at my house with one of Epstein's victims. Now, maybe, as White House Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt said, Democrats, quote, selectively leaked emails to create a fake narrative to smear President Trump. Okay. If so, I suspect that can all be cleared up in very short order by simply releasing the full Epstein files being held and covered up by the Department of Justice. If they reveal that Trump did nothing wrong, and the Democrats are selectively leaking a few of them in order to smear him, well, the release of all the files will both, A, make that clear, and B, cite those Democrats, name those names, those Democratic officials that are supposedly named in the files. Sounds like a win-win if that's the case for all of the Epstein files to be released immediately. A win-win for Republicans, right? So why is Trump preventing that from happening? Wouldn't he want to clear his name and sully all of those Democrats in the bargain? I don't know. Maybe that's not actually the full story, but maybe we will find out soon enough. On Wednesday afternoon, Arizona's Adelita Grijalva was finally sworn in to office in the U.S. Congress, and she immediately signed, as promised, the discharge petition right there on the floor of the House, becoming the 218th member to sign. That is a majority of House members, and that begins what I understand to be a seven-day clock, after which the vote on whether to take a vote on releasing the Epstein files must occur under House rules when a majority of members have signed on to a discharge petition. Essentially, it allows them, generally, the Speaker of the House sets the agenda about what will and won't come up to the come onto the House floor. But if a majority of members sign on to a discharge petition, then, yes, whatever they want must come before the House, must come up for a vote. And while the White House has been pressing reportedly two of the four Republican members who signed on to the discharge petition to have them remove their names. The four are Thomas Massie of Kentucky. He's the co-sponsor of the bill. Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia has signed on, so has Colorado's Lauren Boebert and South Carolina's Nancy Mace. Well, the White House has reportedly been pressing Colorado's Lauren Boebert and South Carolina's Nancy Mace to remove their names from the petition. Now, my understanding is that once the petition has the requisite signatures of a majority of House members, that's it. That's the end. It's then those names and the fact that a majority signed on to the discharge petition is entered into the Federal Register and frozen for all time.
That they cannot remove their names once that happens.
Correct.
Ah.
That's my understanding. So even if Boebert or Mace decided that they wanted their names taken off, it would be too late to do so. That's my understanding anyway. But as you know, these guys play pretty fast and loose with actual federal laws, much less congressional procedural rules. So we will see. Carolyn Leavitt, who was boasting about how transparent the White House has been in all of this, was asked about the White House effort to convince Lauren Boebert to take her name off the petition. And here's what Leavitt responded on Wednesday.
Why are White House officials then meeting with Representative Boebert in an effort to try and get her to not sign this petition, calling for the release of the files?
Doesn't it show transparency that members of the Trump administration are willing to brief members of Congress whenever they please? Doesn't that show our level of transparency? Doesn't that show the level of transparency when we are willing to sit down with members of Congress and address their concerns? That's a defining factor of transparency.
That's the defining factor of transparency, is inviting in members of Congress and telling them how to vote.
In the Situation Room, so that they can't record that information.
Is that right? It was in the Situation Room?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they can't record it. Tell them how to vote. Totally transparent. Meanwhile, do not release tens of thousands of pages, photographs, videos, etc. Do not release that information, because transparency? Like I say, a vote is supposed to be taken in 7 days, though that may mean 7 congressional days when the House is in session. But we will see. I also, by the way, have a very difficult time believing that even if this vote does go forward, and even if a majority of House members vote to demand the release of these files, I have a very difficult time believing that the administration, if they lose that vote, as expected, is actually going to release those files unredacted, is actually going to follow an order from the House of Representatives. But we shall see. That'll come later. I suspect there'll be a lot of news about all of this in the days ahead, even as Congress is still trying to finish up the business of, reopening the federal government. So much more to come on all of the above. For now, let's take a quick break. We'll come back with Richard R.J. Esko on Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani and the affordability of his affordability agenda in New York City. And is it really going to turn the city into a communist hellscape? That is straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Five major corporations now control more than 80% of the media in the United States, but they don't control us. The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. You can make a difference. Support independent media. Drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
New York, like a scene from all those movies, but you're real enough to me. But there's a heart that lives in New York.
Yes, there is. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. In the 1932 U.S. Supreme Court case, New State Ice Company versus Liebman, Justice Louis Brandeis famously observed that, quote, a single courageous state may, if its citizens choose, serve as a laboratory and try novel social and economic experiments without risk to the rest of the country. It has since then become a well-worn axiom in the U.S. that the states are the laboratories for democracy because they can experiment with policies, as Brandeis said, without risk, by and large, to the rest of the nation, and offer a sort of proof of concept for ideas that may later influence national legislation. If states, then, are laboratories for democracy in this nation, it stands to reason that cities are, therefore, laboratories for their own states, and that big cities in those states, like New York City, can serve as laboratories for the state and then, of course, the rest of the nation. And that may be one reason, arguably even the largest reason, that so many Republicans and too many so-called conservative Democrats had been kind of freaking out over the past several months about the election of charismatic 34-year-old self-described Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani as mayor of New York City, as he ran on an affordability agenda that included such radical ideas as a temporary rent freeze for a large number of rent-controlled apartments in the city, free and fast local buses, free universal child care for New Yorkers, and a pilot program for city-owned grocery stores across the five boroughs, beginning with one store in each borough to help both provide fresh produce in food deserts across the city and help lower grocery prices for residents by selling at or near cost. Those are the radical ideas that caused about a million heads to explode in abject terror across the political and media spectrums over the past several months in the lead up to the November 4th off-year election following Mamdani's stunning victory in the Democratic primary earlier this year in the very Democratic-leaning city, where the winner of the party's primary election almost always goes on to become mayor in the November general election. Despite a months-long fear-mongering campaign against Mamdani, often focused on his Muslim background, but also on his now well-known promise of an affordability agenda led by those four programs, a rent freeze, free buses, universal child care, and a city-owned grocery store pilot program, a very well-funded independent campaign against him, led by former Governor Andrew Cuomo, the disgraced member of one of the Empire State's most well-known political dynasties, well, Mamdani won in what pretty much amounts to a landslide in the general election against both Cuomo and Republican challenger Curtis Sliwa. Mayor-elect Mamdani will be sworn in now to office on January 1, when he will then be able to begin implementing his promised programs for the Big Apple, or at least begin trying to do so. Given the pushback received during the course of the campaign, and of course, the idea that successful implementation of these programs in the laboratory of New York City could become models for similar programs elsewhere in the state and indeed across the country, we can almost certainly assume that opposition toward their implementation will be fierce in the days ahead. In some cases, he'll need to win support by the from the state government to implement new city policies, thanks to a federal mandate during the 1970s credit crisis in the city that resulted in the state legislature being allowed to take over certain spending policies for the city. So whether those policies can actually be implemented, well, that remains to be seen. And, of course, the issue of how much each of those programs might cost to implement for city residents, well, that was also a key line of attack against Mamdani's proposals, with many on the right describing them as expensive, socialist, actually communist, as Trump absurdly described him, communist ideas that the city simply could not afford. Well, our old friend and fellow old school blogger Richard R.J. Eskow had another take, however, as the city and indeed the nation was waiting for returns from the general election to come in, when he argued, quote, "Here's something for New York City residents and observers outside New York to consider as they watch the vote count. For the most part, Zohran Mamdani's plans for the city are surprisingly affordable. Despite the frantic tone of mainstream media coverage and the revolutionary overtones of the phrase Democratic Socialist, most of Mamdani's agenda could be accomplished at minimal cost to the city," writes Eskow. "The only exception is his plan for universal free child care, whose costs may have been overstated by Mamdani's own campaign." Quote, "I wish all revolutions came this cheap," quips Eskow in conclusion, after breaking down what each of Mamdani's best-known campaign promises should actually end up costing the public. With the campaign and election finally behind us and the difficult work of governing now ahead in what could prove to be a very interesting experiment for the nation in the great laboratory of democracy known as New York City. To discuss all of that is our old friend, Richard Eskow, longtime writer, columnist, host, and managing editor of the Zero Hour weekly radio and TV program. Oh, Mr. Eskow, it has been way too long, but welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
It's great to be back and great to be speaking with you, Brad.
Delightful to have you here, my friend. All right, so it was sort of difficult to focus on this amid the heat of the campaign, given all the stuff and nonsense that was being hurled at him from both the right and the supposed left. But now seems to be a good time to sort of focus on, well, A, whether Mayor Mondani can actually implement these programs. He will, of course, in many cases need to get support from both the city and the state legislature. B, whether they are even affordable for the city, and see if so, who will actually pay for them no matter what they end up costing. Now, I thought your column was really helpful, Richard, particularly on the affordability piece of the affordability agenda. So I kind of want to run through your calculations on each of the four major programs that topped his campaign agenda, which you characterize in at least three of the four proposed ideas as, yes, surprisingly inexpensive. Let's go in your order here, beginning with the city-owned grocery store pilot program that I heard many in the corporate media, not just his political opponents, but, you know, moderators on CNN describing as free grocery stores, Richard. So first, what is Mondani's actual proposal here on that front, and how can New York City possibly afford it?
Well, let's start with this. They're not free. They're not giving away free groceries. They would be city-run grocery stores that don't need to earn a profit, that would use city property, so it's rent-free, and would operate at cost. And the objections to it, first of all, in terms of cost, estimated cost of that pilot program, we'll get back to the pilot program in a second, is $60 million. Now, bearing in mind that New York City has a total budget of somewhere in the neighborhood of $117 billion, $60 million is less than a rounding error in terms of cost. Secondly, it is a pilot program. He's not intending to nationalize the grocery stores that are in place or replace them. And I wanted to also add that New Yorkers, even more so than many of the rest of us, are already paying a kind of invisible tax on food because there's just too much markup in the process. But New Yorkers pay a larger percentage of their income than Americans as on average. So there is a food cost problem in New York City. So the cost of the program is trivial. It's a pilot program. So if it turns out not to work, the most damage that will be done is that tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers will have gotten low-cost groceries for a year or two and been able to put the rest of their survival income into the city economy overall, which should have a kind of stimulus effect. And then in terms of the idea that governments can't run grocery stores, which is another thing we hear, only the private sector knows how to do that well. We've had a massive system of military commissaries and PXs for many, many years in this country. We've had Costco, which is very successful. We've had small towns and cities already opening public grocery stores. And as I say in the piece, their problems and needs do differ a little bit from a city like New York's and from other urban areas. New York doesn't have the severe food deserts other places have, but but they do need to do something. There is a grocery store shortage. They are paying too much in New York City for groceries. So this is really a very, very low cost experiment that, if it works, could address the affordability crisis that middle class, working class New Yorkers are experiencing.
I don't know. I'm still reeling from the fact that you pointed out that the military has commissaries that sell groceries that are also successful, as if you are charging our military with being some sort of socialist communists or something over there. I don't know, Richard. I lived myself in New York City for about a decade or so back in the 80s and 90s. Even then, before massive corporate consolidation in the industry, prices in New York City for groceries were far more expensive than they were elsewhere. So who has been leading this opposition to Mom Donnie's grocery store plan, as far as you could tell, Richard?
Well, I think it's part of the whole billionaire rhetorical assault. I think it's being used primarily, you know, he's got enormous billionaire opposition, as we know. Mm-hmm. And I think they're using it as a way to kind of invoke, well, the government can't do anything well. And isn't that what the Soviet Union did, run grocery stores? And so I think they're overlooking the fact that, you know, small towns in the Midwest heartland are doing it too. So I think it's just part of the, you know, fear mongering over democratic socialists. And of course, the grocery chains, yeah. You know, everybody's saying, well, Mom Donnie, you know, or his enemies were all saying, well, Mom Donnie cuts videos at bodegas, but he's going to put he wants to put the bodegas out of business. Well, it's not the bodegas he's targeting. People don't buy there. Yeah. I mean, if you've ever shopped at a bodega, you don't normally buy essentials, right. Grocery essentials there. It's the, you know, it's the chains that are worried about this, and they should be.
It's the guy, the CEO of Gristiti's and D'Agostino supermarket chains, right. John Katsimatidis. He has been really loud in opposing Mom Donnie on this, saying it's unrealistic, that this can never be done. It's a threat to his private grocery business, that he has even threatened to close his stores in the city if this proposal moves forward. I say good riddance, sir. But his behavior during the campaign, even on election night, I think he was the guy who was just, you know, cursing out Curtis Sliwa for not staying in the for not getting out of the race. I think that was John Katsimatidis, if I'm not mistaken. Those are the kind of, yeah, the billionaires, the billionaire class who oppose this idea. God forbid we should have, you know, groceries that are sold at a reasonable rate. All right, let's talk about the idea of fast and free buses, which your piece begins by noting that ridership in the city on these buses is already free for about half of the city's bus riders. How so? And I guess how much will it cost to make those buses free for the other half as well under Mom Donnie's plan?
Well, first of all, if you ride a bus or subway in New York City, you will, and especially a bus, you'll notice a lot of people, especially kids and, you know, they just get on. I mean, the bus driver has no way to stop them. So the Transit Authority did a study. It found that 48%, that is to say pretty much half of the people who ride the city's buses, don't pay the fare. So another way to put that is that the city's bus system is already half free. We're just talking about the other half, the people who don't want to break the law, the people who don't want to break the rules, the people who would take the bus if they could, but they wind up walking 15 blocks, are used deliberately to be conservative. You should forgive the expression of my estimates. I use the New York Times, no friend of Mom Donnie's. They estimated it would cost $600 million in lost fares if you made the buses free. Now, that means they're already losing $600 million in fares for the other half, right? Mm-hmm. They also argue that the cost could rise to $800 million in lost fares if more people decide to ride them once they're free. But that doesn't make sense because you wouldn't collect the money either way. We could say it's a large number, but it's 0.5% of New York City's 2026 budget for something that will make life more affordable and pleasant for lots of people. And that increased ridership will make the fast part easier to do, because how do you make buses fast? Dedicated bus lines is the primary tool in that. And it's a lot easier to get political support for dedicated bus lines if more people can ride the buses for free, if they know the buses are there for them. So 0.5% of New York City's budget to make the buses free. And by the way, this is talked about as if this is some radical communist idea. I now live in Montgomery County, Maryland, just outside D.C., where some of our buses are free. Michael Bloomberg, who put in some $50 million or something to...
communist. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
he had a free bus proposal, limited free bus proposal. I believe there are other cities that are doing the same.
Oh, yeah.
So the universality of the free buses is a little bit different. I think here it's ride on buses or something. But it's not a crazy idea, and it's something that would make the city more livable.
And then there is Mamdani's call for a rent freeze on roughly 30% of the city's rental units. That amounts to anywhere from, I think, 1 to 2 million apartments. How much would that communist idea cost the city, and who pays for it?
Zero.
What?
Because, of course, first of all, it doesn't, because of rent rules of various kinds, it would apply to, you know, roughly a third of the city's rental units. Mm-hmm. But the city doesn't have to spend anything. So the objections to it are strictly corporate and big developer, big realtor market driven. They throw out a lot of speculative numbers. But the only number we know for sure is that cash strapped New York City residents who pay way too much as a percentage of income on rent will have more money to spend for the necessities of life. And who knows, maybe even a small pleasure or two, as subversive as that sounds. Maybe they're entitled to go to a diner once in a while, which will provide an immediate boost to the city's economy. Again, a kind of spike in the city's GDP. And by the way, I love that you mentioned the states as laboratories, because if New York City were a state, it would be larger than 38 other states in this country.
Right.
So, which is part of the reason for the hysteria, too. So this is actually a free proposal. And I didn't throw into the article, but I'll throw in here. I often think of my grandfather, who came here as a refugee, as my grandmother did, from Russia, and lived in New York City his whole life, raised a family of four on his single income as a tailor, owning a tailor shop on the Upper West Side, and thanks to things like rent control, had a lovely, what they now call a pre-war, of course it was before the war, so everything was pre-war then, what they now call a three-bedroom or two-bedroom pre-war apartment, which costs a fortune now in the so-called free market, rental market. But this is what made New York City, the vibrant city that I knew as a kid and I knew when I lived there, was the ability of working people to live and have a decent life. You know, my uncle, Mamdani, has been close to the taxi driver community. Mm-hmm. My great uncle, Jack Eskow, was a taxi driver, and by the way, numerologist, go figure, who also raised a family of four on a taxi driver's income.
Right.
These are things that programs like these can do for working people, and they can make New York a city for everyone again.
So grocery store pilot program, about $60 million. That's a pittance, really. Fast and free bus service, anywhere from $600 to $800 million. That's a, you know, no small number for most cities in the country, but from for a city like New York City, it's barely half of a percent of the annual budget. Rent freeze won't cost the city anything and will actually put money in the pockets of tenants, people who live there, that they can then spend in the city. It's actually something that New York City might make money from in that sense. And then we get to the his fourth major proposal, free universal child care. Now, this is the one program that you describe as actually expensive. The idea of free child care across all five boroughs, which the Mamdani campaign cited as costing about $6 billion. Well, now we're talking about real money, even for New York City, no?
Right. Sure. That would be about 5% of the city's current budget, give or take. And but first of all, I would say that while the Mamdani estimate, campaign estimate, was $6 billion, another group that's been advocating for this for a while, the Fiscal Policy Institute, mm-hmm. Came with an estimate of $2.5 billion, which is still a lot of money, but considerably less. And I think there was a third group that I didn't quote my piece that had a quote of about $4 billion. But clearly, you know, it's going to cost some money. Now, this, again, this is not something that's never been done. New York City recently, I'm sorry, New Mexico, the state of New Mexico, after much organizing, had a referendum on free universal child care, and it passed, enormously popular, something like 70% overall voter approval, that will provide free and universal child care to the residents of that state. But they had a ready-made revenue stream. They're taking it from the royalties that fossil fuel companies pay to the state of New Mexico for drilling on state land. New York, first of all, this would have to be done at the state level, presumably. Well, most of it would be. There's no such revenue source in New York. But Mamdani's revenue proposal, if it all passed, which would require the cooperation of Albany leadership, it would cover the child care program with another $4 billion left over, even including about $3.9 billion, even if you include all these other programs we've talked about. But any increases to the state tax would, as I say, have to go through Albany. He's talking about 11.5% top corporate sales tax for the state of New York. That is, if that sounds high to anybody, it's what is already in place across the river in the People's Republic of New Jersey. Not exactly crazy talk. And then the other piece of it is he could raise $4 billion from a city tax increase on annual income over $1 million, which is, I point out in the piece, that would still leave most of those affected, meaning people who make $1 million more a year, paying less than they did before 2017 and Trump's tax cut. And then Mamdani also raises another $1 billion from procurement reform and improved tax collection. There's an enormous default rate on property taxes in New York City, for example. And so that comes to $5 billion, which is less than the Mamdani estimate for universal child care, but it's double the other estimate. So, and if in fact Mamdani's team is right at $6 billion, well, then they could do some intermediate steps, you know, needs-based program to begin with, or start with a certain age range where the need is great. So, again, it's all doable. Yeah. It's all affordable. The rest is just scare tactics.
Yeah, and politics, the idea of, you know, being able to, that you have to go to not just the New York City Council, but to the state legislature to get approval. I was interested. I was in your article, you linked over to Mamdani's his how to pay for the Mamdani agenda document. And he points out that New York City taxes everyone at the same rate, regardless of whether you make $50,000 a year or $5 million a year. And they, he notes our state corporate tax rate is already lower than all neighboring states, not just New Jersey, not just the socialist mecca of New Jersey, but Connecticut, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Vermont, Rhode Island, even New Hampshire. So he's essentially calling for both an increase in the corporate tax, which seems reasonable, up to match New Jersey's, and the idea that he's calling for essentially a progressive tax system in the city where, you know, millionaires will pay more than somebody who makes $50,000 a year. A progressive tax system in the city, as we already have at the state and federal levels across the country. That doesn't seem like a crazy communist idea either, Richard.
No, none of it does. And, I, my theory is, and what I'm writing about now, is it's the presentation of all of it that's threatening. Well, first of all, they don't want to give up the money. Mamdani's own website misstates what it would cost someone making $1 million. They said it would cost them $20,000 more a year. No, it wouldn't cost them anything more a year. It's a marginal tax. It's an incremental tax. Mm. Somebody making $2 million a year would pay $20,000 more, which is, you know, 1%. It's really, but they don't want to give up the 1%. Mm-hmm. They don't want to pay their property taxes on their expensive luxury apartments and so on. But more than that, I think it's the presentation. It's not that this stuff is crazy expensive or crazy radical. It's that the presentation is that, you know what, working people deserve to have an affordable, pleasant, decent life in New York City as they did for 200 years. And I think that's what threatens them the most. And that's where the struggle comes in.
It's interesting when you say that, the presentation. And in the case of Mamdani, the presentation was a very affable, you know, likable fellow of good spirit, you know, right, who is saying, hey, we can do this. We can afford this. We can do these four things to almost immediately make your life better there. And so the idea that they're afraid of the presentation, I think that they're afraid of, gosh, what if everybody starts, having these happy programs that people actually enjoy, that the workers can actually enjoy, the lower income folks? I think there is something to that, that they're afraid of that presentation, that, gosh, we don't have to live as you folks on the right have been suggesting for so many years. And Richard, you say, I wish all revolutions came this cheap. You sort of quip in your article. But in fact, I mean, is there anything particularly revolutionary about his proposals, or these don't seem radical? You said, you know, New Mexico is doing the same thing when it comes to universal child care. The military does the same thing when it comes to grocery stores. This doesn't seem to be particularly revolutionary at all. Is it just because he calls himself a democratic socialist that allows idiots like, you know, Donald Trump to try and tar him as some sort of radical communist revolutionary?
Well, I think so. And I think that's, well, I should say, I think that's part of it. I think that the unapologetic nature of it, I think that the fact that it's part of a broader agenda that says working people have a right to live a decent life. I mean, God forbid if everybody started to believe that in this country, the millionaires, billionaires, I sound like my old boss Bernie, the millionaires, billionaires, their privileges and their control over the political discourse and their, most of all, their control over wealth would be really threatened, not by what Mamdani is doing, but by the fact that, you know, there are a lot of other things going on, whether it's crushing union organizing rights in right-to-work states and not passing the Employee Free Choice Act. And I think it's why a lot of corporate Democrats were threatened by him, too. It's like, if our voters start expecting this from us, you know, fundraising is going to become tough. Now, I credit the ones who, like Kathy Hochul, not a lefty, who stood up and said, you know, he's my party's nominee, I'll back him. I have no respect for the Chuck Schumers of this world.
Thank you.
Who did not.
Yes.
And I think, you know, and they're part of the phenomenon I call vote blue, will tell you who, you know.
And shameful, shameful that a senator from New York City, the Democratic minority leader in the U.S. Senate, can't bring himself to endorse, much less even say out loud who he was going to vote for on Election Day, you know, that cannot get behind the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City. Just shameful, and just one more reason. Chalk it up. Add it to his failure on the shutdown for
absolutely
him to be run out of Dodge, frankly, as Senate leader.
And the fight he should have put up in February over the initial budget. So, you know, it's just cascading failures. You know, they say lead, follower, get out of the way. He's not leading. He wouldn't follow the voters in his own district or his own home city.
Yeah.
I think it's time for him to get out of the way.
I could not agree more. Let me ask you one more before I let you go, Richard
sure.
Eskow. On the day after Zoran won by a landslide in New York City, Donald Trump, I've referenced this a few times, that he was interviewed on Fox News, and he had this to say about that.
Look, for 1,000 years, communism has not worked. It just communism or the concept of communism has not worked. I tend to doubt it's going to work this time.
So, you know, he's asked about Democratic Socialist Zoran Mamdani, and he says, you know, communism doesn't work. Now, setting aside that communism was invented in the 1850s, not thousands of years ago, setting aside the fact that, you know, Trump will tell us that communist China is the greatest threat faced by the U.S. and the world. So I guess communism works well enough for that. But New York City voters did not buy this whole communist attack on Zoran Mamdani, who describes himself as a democratic socialist. Now, Richard, you served, you mentioned this, you served as a writer for the lead writer for the 2016 presidential campaign of, yes, democratic socialist Bernie Sanders. Can you quickly explain, and I'm sure it won't make a difference to Donald Trump, but can you quickly explain how democratic socialism differs from, for example, communism, since Americans still do not seem to understand the difference, apparently?
Democratic socialism, think Norway or Sweden. It's you know, democratic means the people get to decide how to use the resources that we share in common. I always say democratic socialists, or you know, you can call me a social security socialist. If you like social security, if you like Medicare, mm-hmm. if you want more programs like that, and if you want to strengthen and expand those programs, you may be a democratic socialist.
What?
If, as you know, and
how I dare think, you, sir?
You know, and I think it's funny that, and from my point of view, gratifying, having gone to work for Bernie 10 years ago, that saying socialist isn't good enough anymore. Trump has to escalate to communist.
Yeah.
1,000 years ago, he might have been thinking about Jesus, actually. But and I was also amused that Sean Hannity said, if the socialists take over, we're ruined. He said the socialists took over when Barack Obama was elected.
Yeah.
And ironically, I think that the Republican rhetoric about Obama, who is no socialist or democratic socialist, I think the rhetoric about Obama made it easier for real democratic socialism to gain in popularity.
Mm.
They were like, if that's it, it's not so bad.
No, I guess call me one of those crazy communists who, you know, likes the interstate highway system, likes roads without potholes in them, likes the libraries, likes Social Security, and right. you know, it's these crazy lefty programs like that, I guess.
Yeah, and just, you know, I didn't answer your question about communism. I worked in the communist world when it was for the State Department, actually, as an agent of the West, as a advisor. I mean, in communism, they would own all the factories. They would, you know, you had to apply to the state for a place to live. You had to wait for the state system. Now, that's not every form of communism, but that's the state, what my friend Richard Wolff calls a state capitalism model of communism. So if you wanted a phone, you had to wait 9 months till the agency decided to come around and put a phone in for you. But that's the kind of communism that Trump's talking about. There are other kinds, decentralized and so on. But democratic socialism and communism are very different from each other. And, you know, private property is fine, but not the resources that we should all, you know, use for everyone's, but not the water, not the air, you know, but your house, your car, you want it, you got it.
Is Donald Trump's taking ownership of 10% of Intel, the Intel Corporation, would that be communism or would that be democratic socialism?
You know, Trump, I've actually been supportive of doing something like that. In many cases, for example, the government designed and built the infrastructure and concepts for the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Why not own a percentage of internet companies or take a percentage of revenue?
Mm-hmm.
But what Trump's doing is a little different. He's cutting deals and then taking 10% of the profits that result in part from those deals. And to me, this is not public ownership of a communist or democratic socialist kind. You know, democratic socialism, for example, may start a state venture or a venture that's both state and privately owned, but it's not going to, it's really more of a communist move to actually impound or take over, nationalize a private company, unless it's a utility or something, in which case, frankly, I'd be for it. So what Trump's doing is his odd own dictatorial. He's not doing it as part of a policy. He's not doing it as part of a vision. He's just arm twisting. So
just the thuggery.
Yeah, the concept doesn't bother me, but it feels like fealty to the capo rather than giving the people a stake in a venture.
I guess I owe him an apology. It's not communism. It's just fascism. Maybe that's the better word for it.
Yeah, because fascism is a marriage of state and corporate power.
Correct.
So that's not a bad. Yeah.
There you go. And as we know, fascism hasn't worked in 1,000 years. Richard R.J. Esko is the broadcaster you will find on TV and radio at thisisthezerohour.com. You can also read his work at zerohourreport.com, and you can find him on the social medias, in this case, Blue Sky at Esko. Great to catch up with you, Richard. Let's not have it be 2 or 3 more years until we do it again, sir.
That's a deal, Brad. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, brother. Okay, we have got to get out.
Yes, but lots to think about there. I really liked that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
And you're welcome. That's our producer, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, want to share it with anyone you know, love, or hate, you can always download it for free at bradblog.com or your favorite podcast site. But if you visit bradblog.com, you have the opportunity to hit a donate button to help us stay on your public airwaves. Bradblog.com/donate will get you right there. Drop me an email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, you will find me at The Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1995. That was the day that healthcare workers in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, walked off the job in a wildcat strike. Budget cuts in Alberta, under the leadership of Premier Ralph Klein, had hit healthcare particularly hard. A massive restructuring plan called for deep cuts, privatization, and reducing services. As part of this trend, the Calgary Regional Health Authority had decided to contract out the work of 120 laundry personnel. The workers were members of the Canadian Union of Public Employees, Local 8. The laundry workers walked off the job in protest. Soon, they were joined in solidarity on the picket line by housekeepers, orderlies, nurses, and other hospital workers. 8 hospitals across the city were impacted by the walkout. Community members joined in and marched on the picket lines, frustrated by the government cuts. Twice, the Labor Relations Board ordered the workers to go back to their jobs. Twice, the workers refused. The strike spread to Calgary, where more than 2,500 healthcare workers walked off the job. In Edmonton, workers stood ready to strike. Talk of a general strike began to circulate. In Calgary, the union met with management for a 19-hour marathon bargaining session, and the 10-day strike ended. The health authority agreed to wait 8 months before contracting out any labor. Workers were given severance packages, and the government stopped any further cuts to the industry. But the settlement did little to appease the dissatisfaction of the healthcare workers. The strike had also shown the potential connections between workers' issues on the job and the concerns of community members. The cutbacks hurt both labor and the general public and brought them together to stand in solidarity. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.